Hello and welcome. You're listening to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism. Coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. I'm Chrysanthi Giotis. The lucky country has done it again. The curve has been flattened and bent, and the number of new cases is, dare I say, vanishingly low, and more importantly, stable. So the talk has now turned to the opening of our society and economy. In this edition, we will ask not just how will society return back to normal, but should we also make some changes on the journey back? If so, what role will the media play in what Anthony Albanese has called a once-in-a-century moment to rethink and renew? And 2GB shock jock Alan Jones is hanging up the headphones and leaving breakfast radio. Why was Jones such a huge figure in Australia, and does his departure open the door for a new kind of conversation? To discuss all of this, we are joined, remotely, by two deep-thinking journalists. Jeff Lemon is a writer and broadcaster. He's a co-presenter in the Final Word Cricket podcast, and his work can be found in The Guardian. Jeff Lemon, welcome to Fourth Estate.
Thank you, nice to be here.
Jacqueline Malley is a senior journalist and columnist at Nine Sydney Morning Herald. She has also been the Canberra Press Gallery sketchwriter. Jacqueline Malley, welcome back to Fourth Estate.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, 90%+ of us have done what we were asked to do, namely stay home and socially isolate. Our economy and our way of life has been placed in a coma. But now, as we start to work our way out of the lockdown, there are calls in the wings to not just get back to normal, but perhaps to build back better. So with my guests here, let's break it down. Is this possible? What issues can and should we tackle? And what is the role of the media in all of this? Can I perhaps start on a human level by asking you both, what have you discovered you've missed the most? And what are you glad to have seen the back of during the lockdown? Jacqueline, can I start with you? What is it that you have missed the most?
Oh, gosh. I miss the collegiality of my office. I miss the esprit de corps of a newsroom and the ideas that you get and, you know, the sort of the help, I suppose, and support that you get just from chatting with your fellow journalists in the office. I miss that a lot. And I write features, and I suppose a lot of writing features is observational stuff. So going out to meet people, hanging out with them, being a fly on the wall, going along with them to do whatever it is that they do and just watching them. And we can't really do that at the moment. I think probably increasingly we'll be able to maybe now, but it's just a bit hard to get that sort of, yeah, that really observational stuff that is the grist for feature writing.
Yeah, that humanity. Jeff, can I turn to you? What have you discovered that you've missed the most?
I think it's more on a personal than a professional level, because professionally often writers end up isolating themselves anyway. But we know that humans are social animals, but then to have that removed, to be unable to see your friends or see anybody beyond the people living in your home in any sort of extended way, it just changes the way that you relate with the world. I've felt a lot more like an isolated little speck within the world rather than being part of something bigger. And that being part of something bigger is the thing that makes us want to get up in the morning and keep existing in the societies that we live in. So it's been really difficult on that front. And just being able to have the comfort of company is something that's going to be really important if we can get that back up and running.
Yeah, absolutely. So you touched on there being part of something bigger. What about what we aren't missing? Anything we want to see extinct in a new normal Australia? Jacqueline, I'll start with you again.
I guess on a personal level, I just love the peace of it, actually. You know, the number of activities and things that you do that you realise were completely sort of non-essential or extraneous to happiness. I've quite liked the piece of it. In terms of in the broader society, I mean, and in politics, I mean, it's difficult to know what we could possibly wish for. I mean, we say, you know, it was pretty amazing, I think, to see politics as usual, or the conflict and the sort of standard ideological divisions of politics fall aside, even if it was for a fairly brief moment. And I think we did have a real commonality and a communitarianism or a sense of communitarianism that you don't often see. And it was good to sort of rediscover that we were capable of it. And I think it's actually given me greater faith in Australia's sort of civil society. I think we've done pretty well on the whole at following the rules, but also looking after each other and cooperating with each other. And certainly you would much rather be in Australia than in a country like the United States. So that's all been really good. In terms of the things that I am happy to sort of farewell for good, look, I mean, I'd love to have farewelled like things like, you know, the National Party division that we've seen in recent times, the sort of self-absorbed narcissism of some politicians. But I just don't think that's going to happen. I think it's all going to come rushing back in.
Oh, goodness me. Jeff, what about you? What would you be happy to see the back of?
Well, I don't think we're going to see the back of it. But like Jacqueline said, the noise, I suppose I'd define it as, all of the extraneous hype in terms of political division, that has died down a fair bit. We're still seeing a lot of it from people like the Victorian Liberals, who are trying to get some sort of relevance or attention in a situation where they're not actually contributing anything or achieving anything. But it's been a relief to see a lot of that noise die down for a little while. And that's reflected in sports reporting as well, I think, where it's kind of been a relief that there's been no football of any kind, because all of the hype around that, all of the sort of overinflated media cycle around that, where there's just so much focus, so much detail, so much forensic everything on which player put up a tweet that said this or whatever it might be. Since the sports reporting agencies haven't had much to report on, they've just done less, which has been a bit of a relief. So look, I'd love to see some of that restraint continue, but I don't think it will. I think it'll come back double and worse, because everybody will be trying to make up for lost time in terms of attention and revenue and clicks and advertising.
Wow. Okay, something to not look forward to, I guess, if that's what you're predicting. Can I actually try something else? Jeff, you were recently on an Australia at Home panel discussing the issue of pokies. Yeah. Gambling more generally, but I'll start with pokies. Should they finally go? So just to put this in perspective, in 2017 to 2018, Australians gambled $219 billion, with the vast majority, $150 billion, lost on the pokies. Pokies make up almost 70% of all monies lost through gambling. And that gambling bill is about the same as the unprecedented COVID stimulus package. And the pokies losses is $20 billion more than what was spent on the wage subsidy scheme. So on this issue, like, could we say pokies have been closed? Let's just keep them that way.
It would be lovely if we could. There will be a very influential push back against that. We saw how influential the club lobby is when Julia Gillard tried to introduce some pretty minor restrictions on poker machines in terms of maximum bets and maximum losses a few years ago. And that eventually was stymied because the club's industry was able to militate against that. So I think we'd see a similar sort of pushback. But what we have seen is that with those venues closed, there is a precedent that it is possible to not have this in our society. We've been able to see, and there probably will be studies that can be done to have a look at what effect that might have had. And in terms of looking at a society that's prepared to spend money on things that will be for the good of its constituents, a lot of the argument for poker machines is that they fund clubs that do good works in the community. But when you look at the very small percentage of revenue that gets donated to those good works, you can find much more efficient ways to fund those good works without losing the benefits. You can get rid of the cause of the harm. So I think there's a stronger position to argue that case from now that we've had this pause in poker machine spending and the way that so much money is gouged out of the local communities.
Yeah, there are some really horror stories as well. So there was the story of the returned vet who had multiple limb losses and got his RSL to help with a compensation claim, and then he just put that entire payout through the pokies at that same RSL.
It's much broader than the pokies as well, because, you know, sports betting has become a hugely subscribed service, and what they're all about is trying to get people to bet during games, you know, to bet on small parts of matches within matches. And so that's another thing that when sport comes back, those companies will be desperately trying to make up any of the revenue that they've missed out on while sport's been on hold.
Yeah, exactly. Jacqueline, Jeff touched there on the Gillard government's attempts to do something. You were up close and saw that. You mentioned earlier that there's a slightly changed political climate. Do you think there's any chance of grabbing this tiger by the tail?
I would say in a word, no. The Gillard government tried to do something about it. And, you know, as Jeff mentioned, with great opposition, only because they were in minority government and they were reliant on, you know, the support of various crossbenchers. And they had a great deal of difficulty with the small reforms that they wanted to make. I don't see any political appetite for it. I think that the only side of politics that would do anything about it would be the Labor side of politics, and they would run into huge amounts of opposition. And at the moment, I think we see Anthony Albanese in the way that he's positioning himself as trying to really win back the kinds of voters that I would imagine would cross over with the people who use poker machines, which is sort of, you know, your blue-collar Anglo or, you know, poorer Australians who live in more disadvantaged and possibly marginal electorates. So I think politically there's probably not much appetite for it, even though it would be, in my view, a fantastic sort of socially worthy thing to do to eradicate or at least substantially cut back pokies in this country.
Well, yeah, I suppose at least we're having the conversation. Another conversation that we are having is about the nature of work, and traditional political forces are positioning on this matter, from the Business Council calling for serious IR reform to the ACTU asking for an increase to the minimum wage. These are the usual players doing what they usually do, just doing it in a crisis. I would like to ask you both, should we be having a more nuanced debate right now, with that debate more open to the public? Jacqueline, I might just stay with you.
I would love to see a more nuanced debate about some of these issues. And I've been feeling some dismay the last week, I suppose, when we see a snapback, if I may use that term, to more traditional political debate, where it's just sort of the same players pushing the same sort of barrows, and it's all very predictable. I think if we have any chance at sort of achieving lasting and good economic reform out of this crisis, then I think it will be best done in a bipartisan environment. So, you know, if we can keep things like the National Cabinet, there's an advisory group to government, which is a sort of group of business and union experts that's sort of working away from this issue now, and particularly tax reform and economic reform. The wage subsidy, the JobKeeper program, you'll remember Scott Morrison and the Treasurer Josh Frydenberg were really resisting the idea of a wage subsidy, up until sort of just a couple of days before they actually announced that they were going to do it. And they were really brought over the line by Sally McManus and Greg Combe, who argued to them forcefully the case for such a subsidy. And they listened, you know, and this was sort of, I guess, lost a little bit maybe in the fog of war, but they listened. They actually, you know, they were ideologically opposed to something. Liberal governments don't like to prop up, you know, use taxpayer money to prop up the wages of ordinary people. But they listened. They listened to the experts. They realised that we were in, you know, sort of dire financial or economic straits, and they changed their mind. And that was pretty extraordinary thing to happen when you look at the sort of the last maybe decade in Australian politics and how difficult it's been for one side to convince the other side that they might have a good idea that's worth trying out. So, if we can see a little bit more of that kind of thing, if we can keep some of that spirit, then we might see some interesting economic reform, you know, I think particularly around tax reform to make the tax system a little bit fairer to young people and to poorer people.
Jeff, if I can turn to you, speaking of young people, yeah. One of the things that really came to light when the pandemic hit was the casualized nature of our workforce and how truly insecure that is, and contract-based workforce, especially in hospitality and retail. Do you think that Australians will be rushing back to the gig economy?
I think they might not have a lot of choice because it's going to be an economy in a state of disrepair. There are going to be a lot of businesses and industries that have gone under or that are struggling to get back up and running. There'll be new ones trying to get operating with as skeletal costs as possible. And so in that situation, I think it will be difficult to find regular and stable employment as opposed to more gig-based type employment. But that's part of what we've seen, part of what's been exposed in the crisis that we've had in terms of the JobKeeper allowance and all the rest of it, is just how many Australians are on really casualised working hours who are not necessarily counted in the unemployment registers, but who are definitely underemployed. And so it's shone a bit of a light on that. I think when we're talking about nuance in the argument, one of the benefits that this crisis can have is that it's actually practically demonstrated a few things that have previously been argued about in abstract terms. So one of those things is the Centrelink allowance, the job seeker allowance, where once the government saw that a huge number of new workers were going to need to get that support, suddenly they recognised that it wasn't enough, the amount being paid wasn't enough to live on, and they had to double it. And that gives you a really strong base to argue that that government welfare should be raised and that it isn't enough because it's been hanging around below the poverty level for a long time, and it certainly hasn't gone up with inflation as it should have. And the other thing we've had demonstrated is the practical nature of more flexible working arrangements. So a lot of people working from home, working flexible hours, building their hours around what their kids need or what their families need or what their health situation needs. And for businesses where that's possible and where that's viable, it hasn't been a problem. They've been able to continue being productive. So we've seen a lot of resistance from a lot of traditional businesses to changing the sort of 9-to-5, 5 days a week model. But if we could change that going forward, that could have a lot of social benefits, just in terms of reducing travel within cities, in terms of people's health, people's overall life satisfaction, and their ability to incorporate their family and their working life to have a better balance. So there are practical things that have happened, demonstrations, if you will give us a base to make better decisions going forward.
That's such a good point about practical demonstrations, and that also needs to be talked about in the media, and then that becomes part of the political conversation. More flexible working arrangements isn't just about showing off your book collection on Zoom. It allows caregivers, the handicapped, and those living outside our major cities a way to enter more broadly into the employment market. Jacqueline, is there any appetite for this kind of debate in Canberra?
The debate about flexible work?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think certainly it's been interesting. Well, I guess I would make the point, first of all, that it's been interesting that the rest of Australia has been able to adapt to flexible work, almost except for the politicians who, after this week, are not going to sit again till August.
It's slightly outrageous, isn't it?
Yeah, when you think about the remarkable and inspiring, dare I say, way that really the rest of Australia has managed to adapt, businesses have adapted, individuals, families, you know, who've got kids at home, everybody else has sort of gotten on with it, and the politicians have completely sort of recalibrated their working schedule. So that's less than inspiring. In terms of flexible work and the casualisation of the workforce, you'll see this is something that the Labor Party will be talking more and more and more about as we move, we make the transition from sort of crisis phase where we had a lot of bipartisanship to now the sort of post-crisis economic cleanup or economic recovery stage. And there'll be more and more distinctions that the Labor Party will want to draw so that it can sort of, seek to define itself in the lead up to the next election. And the casualisation of the workforce will be a huge one. So it will be talking about, not just Australians returning to work, but returning to secure work and being able to find employment that actually gives them the security to, you know, get a mortgage and do all the other things that previous generations have been able to do. So I think that's going to be a major talking point and major policy issue in the aftermath of the sort of major health crisis.
We have had a Liberal government engage in Keynesian economics. You previously said that you don't think we'll be able to maintain this bipartisanship. We will get back to politicking. Do you think it will be as bad as before, though?
I suspect it. I mean, it's impossible to predict, but I'm starting to think it will. Yeah. I mean, we're already seeing, you know, there's sort of various Liberal backbenchers who are pushing to end JobKeeper and the higher job, you know, the higher job seeker rate. I think that most politicians who are pretty cunning will realize, you know, will take to heart the maxim that you should never waste a good crisis, and they'll probably use it to sort of to recycle, to push their own ideological agendas. Scott Morrison has sort of said that instead of coming up with totally new economic reform ideas, they're just going to harvest ones that have already been proposed by, you know, Productivity Commission reports that now sit, you know, that sit idle, gathering dust on shelves. At least if that happened, Productivity Commission usually has some pretty good suggestions that are non-partisan and independently sort of, they've come up with them pretty through an independent process. But look, I think people will probably snap back to their original positions, and I think we'll probably see quite a period of quite bitter contest because the stakes are so much higher now and people's suffering is so much greater. So I think that within the population there'll be probably quite strongly held views on these things that will fire and sort of put pressure on politicians.
You're listening to Fourth Estate on the Community Radio Network. Our guests this week are Jacqueline Malley and Jeff Lemon. Jeff, we were just talking then about politicking. We've had some pretty big issues discussed, and that maybe we can actually use this crisis as a society. However, it's also been a time of unprecedented closures in the media. We've had the news of regional Australia and suburban news closing, and we have some organisations like BuzzFeed, which is closing its Australian news arm. Is there any way that we can have these strong conversations in society when the media is struggling as much as any other part of the economy?
It's very difficult when, in Australia, when you talk about, quote unquote, the media, it's a very limited ecosystem. You know, you're talking about Murdoch Media owning most of the newspapers plus the cable TV network. You're talking about Nine and Fairfax being a conglomerate that run a TV station and the other two major papers. And then aside from that, there's not a lot of diversified voice. You know, that's the reason that Guardian Australia eventually succeeded, was that they were able to establish themselves as providing an alternative voice, but they're still an online-only publication. There's no print Guardian in Australia to reach a different segment of the audience. And all in all, when you look at it compared to the media landscapes of some other countries, I mean, there are countries that are worse in terms of media diversity, but it's a very narrow range of businesses that control the media conversation in Australia. And there's a small amount of independent divergence from that. And a newsroom like BuzzFeed's was that. They punched well above their weight in terms of producing genuine investigative stories, public interest stories that weren't being covered elsewhere. But I think the writing's been on the wall for them for a while. They had layoffs last year, I think it was, with a good chunk of that newsroom disbanded and only a handful of staff has kept on, and now that remaining sliver has been shut down as well. So I think Australia's a difficult media market because it's not that big. There's not that much opportunity for a more niche publication to get the readership and advertising revenue that it needs to keep itself afloat. And so in the kind of society that we live in now, with everything being online, everything being available, it's really hard to fund a genuine news organisation if you don't have a whole lot of other commercial arms that can feed into it and support it, which is what we see with the Murdoch publications, where they're part of a more general strategy for political control, really. So even if those organisations make a loss, they're still worth it to the very wealthy company that keeps them afloat.
You make a good point about the media ecosystem. However, there are smaller countries which have a more diverse media ecosystem. And in Australia, we also have an issue of trust in our media. Jacqueline, you've been writing about this. We've had trust grow in our institutions and in our media. Do you think that there is an opportunity in this crisis for us?
Yeah, I do. I think that we've probably seen a flight to quality, and certainly, I mean, I can't speak for other news organisations, but the Sydney Morning Herald and Age have been on a sort of subscriptions push the last few years, and subscription push, which is very much linked to the quality of the news that you get if you sign up. And we've seen subscriptions really have a terrific boost during this crisis, because there's obviously a hunger for news and there's a hunger for quality, independent and, you know, reliable news. So we've done reasonably well from that side of things. Obviously, advertising has sort of fallen off a cliff, and huge chunks of the advertising market to do with cruising and travel in particular have just been basically cancelled overnight. But I do think there's an opportunity, because because we're so cut off from each other at the moment, and yet it's such a global story that is unfolding, there's a huge opportunity for journalists. I mean, there are stories everywhere, and I've been fascinated just watching the television reports on the ABC, for example, on 7:30 every night, just all these different aspects of the crisis and all these different personal stories that are being lived out under our nose, but if you're an ordinary person, you can't see them because you're not moving in society in the normal way that you would, but journalists can bring them to you. So despite the fact that it's been such a horrific news story, there's been wonderful, wonderful stories of redemption and humanity and of people helping each other, all the kinds of things actually that the media is often accused of never covering. You know, that's something that we get a lot. Jeff probably knows this as well. You get a lot of like, why do you never report the good stuff and the bad stuff? Well, there's actually been heaps of good stuff to report, and people have been reporting it. Yeah, I think there's a huge opportunity, and I think probably a lot of journalists have felt quite enlivened almost by all the different things that we can report upon. You know, long may it last.
Jeff, would you like to talk about that as well?
I suppose there's a sense that everybody is in this situation together in a way that is, to use the horrible word of the time, unprecedented. We've heard that word way too much, but this is literally true in that, you know, there have been a handful of global events like the world wars and the Spanish flu pandemic, but not with the kind of media connection and interconnection that we have now, where we sitting here having this conversation can check in on what some students are saying in South Korea, what frontline health workers are doing in the USA, what's going on with spiking infection rates in Ecuador. We've got all of these connections at our fingertips to be able to call through to colleagues, contact people overseas. The connectivity of it is extraordinary, because almost any news story, no matter how big it is big somewhere, but not necessarily everywhere else. Whereas this story is everywhere. This situation is affecting every country in the world. Even the cases without infections are having to be vigilant to make sure that they don't get them. And there aren't many countries left where the virus hasn't reached. So in terms of that interconnectivity, I think that we could emerge from that, having that as a real positive of the experience. But it's also a vastly different experience from country to country. If you look at the way that Australia has been able to ride this out so far relatively unscathed, apart from some economic cost, versus the incredible human cost overseas in a lot of countries that have been absolutely steamrolled. And there's still the possibility that that can happen here, but it's not at the moment. So our experience of the situation is wildly divergent around the world, depending on where we are. But the fact that we're thinking about the same thing fundamentally, and we're having to work towards fundamentally the same goal, which is restricting and trying to ameliorate the effects of this one virus, is an extraordinary thing in itself.
Okay, from the very global, let's segue to the local. The news that Alan Jones has announced his retirement from radio. On Tuesday, the 2GB breakfast host announced that he was citing doctors' orders to take it easy. The response in our media and on Twitter to the announcement has been as polarising as the man himself. Jacqueline, you have written this week about Alan Jones from your own experiences. He's no normal breakfast disc jockey. How would you describe him?
It's hard to know how nice to be. I mean, look, he's an incredible communicator. He's an unrivaled broadcaster, and he's very, very good at what he does. He has a visceral, emotional connection with his listeners who are so loyal to him. He's been an incredibly powerful force in political life in Australia for really, I mean, he's been broadcasting for 35 years, so really all of that time. And he has, I suppose, just pioneered in Australia a kind of outrage form of broadcasting, which is now being replicated on social media. And in a sense, it's that, you know, outrage on social media, which has in part led to his retirement, perhaps a little prematurely or perhaps a little earlier than he would otherwise have liked, because advertisers have been fleeing him because increasingly his sort of highly aggressive and bullying tactics, in particular against women, the sometimes violence of his metaphors in relation to powerful women, have put him really on the wrong side of history in terms of the way people like, you know, the kinds of things that people and the broader public will tolerate in our civil discourse. So advertisers have been fleeing him, and he just hasn't been making as much money for the network as he used to, even though he's unrivaled in his ratings. So, yeah, I mean, he's been an incredibly powerful force. I wrote this week that, you know, Alan Jones was very good at being Alan Jones, and there's no reason really why we could have expected him to be anything else. But in my mind, the sort of the real pity is the politicians who have really been very, very scared of him, particularly at a state level, for decades, and that you can point to countless examples in planning laws, you know, greyhound racing, you know, the sales of the Opera House and whether or not it's appropriate to advertise on them. Countless examples of governments changing tack, gotten them on radio and bullied them relentlessly and until they've changed course. You could even say, and certainly Malcolm Turnbull would say, that, you know, Alan Jones and other prominent voices were pivotal in bringing down his prime ministership. So he's been really, in terms of his influence, it's a real lesson in how, you know, influence doesn't necessarily, you know, can be very, very outsized compared to your actual ratings, no matter how big they are.
It is a bit like a kingdom in the Game of Thrones, where everyone goes to his 2GB palace to pay tribute.
and it's kind of, you know, Game of Thrones is all about the nature of power, right? Where does true power rest? Does it rest in your numbers? Does it rest in the amount of money you've got? Or is it something a little bit more sort of intangible? And with Alan Jones, I think it was all of those things. But certainly he was feared and revered in the circles and in the corridors of power. And that was really the base or the real source of his power.
We touched earlier that maybe there is a slight change in the political debate. And Jacqueline, you made the excellent point that actually his outrage form of media has transferred to social media, where people can do it themselves and actually turn on him. Mm. Is Jones retiring another reset moment? Jeff, what do you think?
I don't think it's a reset moment, because all that Jones has done is provide a model for other people to follow, and they will. There's money to be made in being publicly execrable, and that's what he's done. I find it really bizarre that there's been this kind of paying of tribute to him from other parts of the media. There's a kind of both sidesism to a lot of our media outlets, where and the desire to be seen to be balanced means that they've had to pay homage and talk about how successful he was at the things he's done, without being able to talk about the obvious things that he was an incredibly destructive person, a horrific human being in the way that he affected the society around him. He was all about ugliness, violence, and anger. He directed that anger at racial minorities, at women, particularly women in power. He had questionable relationships with his students when he was a teacher, and that's something that apparently wasn't enough to disqualify him from being a major voice, at least in state terms, if not so much nationally. He was able to influence government policy when he had no basis to do so. He was a horrific influence in our public life, and it's a blessing that he's gone, but he won't be gone from the TV, he won't be gone from papers, and I'm sure if some other station offered him a contract, his health problems would probably dissipate to the point that he'd be able to take that up. So there's not much relief in one person going, because others will come to take his place following the same model.
Yeah, I would add, I mean, I agree with Jeff in his summation of Alan Jones' character. I mean, he was just a classic bully, really. But I do think it's a little bit of a shift, because he left because, he had doctor's advice and he'd have health problems for years, which are well documented. But he left, essentially, the timing of it was because advertisers were fleeing him. And, you know, they fled him because of the things that he was saying. And the things that he was saying were no longer acceptable to the broader public. And advertisers didn't want to be associated with him. So I do see a little bit of I'm optimistic about that. I think, you know, Alan Jones didn't change for three decades, but the times changed around him, and eventually he was sort of increasingly ousted for being the bully and the dinosaur that he is. So I'm happy about that. I think that probably says something pretty good. And I know when Nine sort of acquired him inadvertently, you know, when they bought 2GB, or when they got 2GB, they were worried about it. You know, it was a bit of a liability, and in terms of the enormous defamation payments that he's had to pay out over the years, or that companies have had to pay out on because of stuff that he said, he was seen increasingly as a bit of a liability, I think. So, look, I think that's all probably, you know, it's positive in terms of the way our civil discourse has maybe advanced a little bit.
That's a great note to finish on. So I will thank my panel for a great discussion. Jeff Lemon, who is a writer and broadcaster, and you can hear more of Jeff in the Final Word Cricket podcast. Jacqueline Malley is a senior journalist and columnist at Nine Sydney Morning Herald. Thank you both.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The Fourth Estate. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation, and we thank them for their continuing support. Make sure you're subscribed to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk media, politics and a few things in between. We'll be back with more next week, but in the meantime you can stay in touch on Twitter. Our handle is FourthEstateAU. Thanks to my excellent producer, Anthony Dockrell. My name's Chrysanthi Giotis. Thanks for listening.